Hello and welcome to the Health and Happiness Show. I'm Edwina Griffin. Thanks for joining the show, where each week I'll be speaking to inspiring thought leaders, researchers and individuals around the causes, effects and paths to finding health and happiness. Last week I chatted to Joe Cross about his movie Fat, Sick and Nearly Dead, when we discussed the health of our physical bodies, our nutrition and the influence of that on our health and happiness. Does the path to perfect health and happiness stem from our minds, body or spirit? This week I'm speaking to someone who has also had an award-winning film written about her. Does anyone remember the saying, sticks and stones may break your bones, but words can never hurt you? Our next guest may challenge that statement. With her theory on mindfulness and her findings in over 200 research papers on the illusion of control, perceived control and successful aging, to name a few, she's proven that our thoughts and minds are more powerful than previously thought. She's a Harvard Professor of Psychology, the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, 3 Distinguished Scientist Awards, the World Congress Award, the NYU Alumni Achievement Award, amongst others. She's also authored 11 books and offered new hope to millions through her work. I'd like to welcome to the show Dr. Ellen Langer. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So I've just finished reading your book on mindfulness, which describes many of your studies in this area. Was there something that happened in your life to inspire you to do research in this area?
I think that when I was young, people would say to me, don't you ever stop thinking, which I understood to mean that I was doing something different from what most people were doing. And then I found with myself and with other people that there were lots of things people were doing that didn't make a lot of sense. You know, sort of you'd walk into a mannequin and you would say, excuse me, things of this sort. Or you'd be feeling deathly ill and someone would ask you, hi, how are you? And you'd say, fine, thank you. And through all of this research over the next 40 years, it became clear to me that mindlessness is pervasive. In fact, almost all of us, virtually all the time, are not there. And you can't have the experience of knowing that you're not there, because when you're not there, you're not there to know it. But the research makes clear that we need to find ways of tuning into the lives we're living instead of being sealed in unlived lives, which is currently more the rule than the exception. And so with all of this research over these many years, we make people more mindful, and I'll explain in a moment what that means. And we find enormous benefits to health and well-being, competence, happiness, authenticity, engagement, memory, creativity. And when we make people more mindful, they even live longer. So mindfulness, as I study it, couldn't be simpler. It's the act of noticing new things. That's all you have to do. And it doesn't matter if the new things you notice are smart or silly, even if they're vulgar. As long as they're new for you, what that does is puts you in the present. Now, everybody pays lip service to the idea that it's good to be in the moment, in the present. The problem is that that is in some ways an empty instruction, because again, when you're not in the moment, you don't know you're not in the moment. But by noticing new things, that puts you in the moment, and it makes you aware that all the things you thought were true are not always true. You know, that when you think you know something well and you look at it more closely, because things are always changing, you find out that this thing that you thought was well known is in many ways brand new, which makes it interesting again to you. This is true in relationships. You know, you're in a relationship for 15 years, for example, and you think you know the person inside out, so you don't really pay any attention to them. If you just looked at that person anew and noticed every day, noticed 3 new things about them, the person would suddenly become interesting to you. The person would feel the interest you're experiencing. And our data suggests the relationship would be improved vastly. In some of these health studies, we've done these especially with older people, where we increase this involvement in novelty, noticing new things, and we find that health on all levels improves, and they end up living longer. And much of the newer research is based on the idea that things, concepts like mind and body, these are just words. And if instead of taking them as seriously in some sense as people have in the past, and we put the mind and the body back together, so to speak, then wherever we're putting the mind, the body is also there. And this simple idea explains things like placebos, spontaneous remissions, and says, basically speaks to how important our ideas, our thoughts, our attitudes, our beliefs are to our health. So let me give you an example of one of these, you know what I'm talking about. In the original counterclockwise study, what we did was we had old people come to a timeless retreat that was retrofitted to 20 years earlier. These were men at the time in their 80s, and this was many, many years ago. And so they spend a week living in this retreat as if it was that earlier time period. So everything that they see, all the conversations, for example, were in the present tense. So the past was experienced as the present. We had a comparison group that reminisced in the same location, talked about the same things, the same topics, but for them, they were always, their minds were in the present, looking back at the past. And what we found was that in as short as 1 week, those people who, in a sense, put their minds in that earlier place showed vast improvements. Their vision improved, their strength improved, their memory improved. They even looked younger at the end of the week's time. So it seems to be a... I'm sorry, go on.
Sorry. I just with that study, I just I read that, was it 18 months down the track, twice as many of the people in the group were alive?
That was a different study. That was really the first in all of these studies with older people. Well, we went to a nursing home, and we gave one group, encouraged them to be mindful by making choices, by caring for a plant, and we gave them a pep talk about how important it was to be making the decisions that they used to make. And the comparison group for that study was just told about the tender, loving care that the staff wanted to provide for them. And then we went back 18 months later, and indeed, that group that was encouraged through this choice-making to be more mindful were more likely to be alive and high-functioning than the comparison group.
Yeah, yeah. So in terms of choice-making, as well as the mindful thinking and the presence in the moment.
Well, the choice-making, the reason that choice is effective is because of the mindfulness, that when you're making choices, you're comparing alternatives, you're noticing subtle differences among the alternatives. And it's that noticing, even if ultimately you didn't decide on one versus the other, just that noticing is what's good for you.
Okay, okay. Now, not everyone practices mindfulness. Like, there's something, in that expression, ignorance is bliss. You know, there are subconscious benefits to mindless thinking in a way. You know?
No, that's completely mindless. That, you know, when people say ignorance is bliss, beneath that statement is the assumption that there's only one way of thinking about information, and that thinking about that information in that way is very stressful. So it would make sense that if the only way I can think about this, if when I think about this, I get myself crazy, I'm better off not thinking about it. But there's nothing that needs to be thought of in that stress-provoking way. So we need to open up these thoughts and look at them from different perspectives. So, for example, somebody might think, well, you know, my spouse is going to leave me, and that's very stressful. And so then they decide, you know, ignorance is bliss. I don't know what he or she is doing. I don't want to think about, you know, I don't want to think about the possibility of us ending the relationship. Well, you don't have those kinds of thoughts if the relationship is high functioning. You know, if both parties are happy in the relationship, you're not going to be worried about the relationship ending. If you have thoughts about the relationship ending, then I think that what you need to do is deal with the relationship. Not be ignorant, because all that'll mean is that eventually the relationship is going to end. You know, I can't think of an instance where not thinking about something is to our advantage. And again, we think we shouldn't think of it because we only know how to think about it in negative ways.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is only part of the pie.
Yes.
Is that clear at all?
Yeah, it is. That is clear because it's, as you say, it's kind of the act of looking for different ways and different approaches to things is part of the mindfulness. Like in terms of like education though, and the systems that we live in government, it's hard to have that sort of mindful approach to our systems. Like some paradigms.
Yeah, what we need to know. I'm sorry to keep interrupting you.
No, you're right.
It's mindless of me. what we need to do is to realize that the facts on which everything is based are just probabilities. You know, science, at its best, can only tell you that some of the time, under these circumstances, this or that will happen. Now, what happens is that these absolutes, conditional statements or findings are translated into absolutes. And it's the absolutes that lead us to be mindless. If I know something is absolutely true, there's no need for me to ever think about it. If I know sometimes it's true, sometimes it's not, then I'm going to be paying more attention to decide, is this one of those times it's true or not true? So even, you know, a simple thing like 1 and 1 is 2. Everybody believes 1 and 1 is 2. But 1 and 1 isn't always 2. It depends on the number system you're using. Also, if you add 1 watt of chewing gum to 1 watt of chewing gum, 1 plus 1 is 1.
Mm-hmm.
So that
mm-hmm.
from the simplest to the most complicated circumstances, there are always alternative views, and those alternative views usually have the effect of, first, coming up with the views is mindful. Mindfulness is energy begetting, not consuming. It's enlivening. You feel engaged. So it's good just for that reason. And then the second is we find alternative ways of looking at the things that are stressful. And then almost by definition, they become less stressful. We become much less evaluative of other people when we do this. So if you're annoying me because I see you as gullible, but I look at this from different perspectives, perhaps your perspective, I recognize that you're not being gullible, you're being trusting. You're not being impulsive, you're being spontaneous. You're not being rigid, you're being consistent, and so on.
Mm.
And then, clearly, a relationship is going to improve, and my thoughts about myself, when I look back at my own behavior and I say, oh my gosh, why was I so impulsive? But if I take a different view and I see myself as spontaneous, I'm less evaluative even of myself. So it leads to a kinder, gentler world, actually.
Yeah. So from your experience,
Go on.
Sorry. Now you've been studying it for a long time.
I've been studying this for so long that it's, you know, I'm excited about sharing the information, but it's also hard to convey 40 years of thinking in a few minutes. So, you know, so I welcome you asking me for clarification.
No, thanks. So,
if I let you talk.
You're on the Health and Happiness Show. I'm Edwina Griffin, and I'm speaking to Dr. Ellen Langer. So, Dr. Langer, can people become mindful from your experience? Can mindfulness be taught?
Yes, that's what I've been doing now for 40 years, is trying to increase the mindfulness that people experience around the globe. Again, it's a very simple thing, but what I tend to do when I'm trying to teach people to be mindful is to first show them, and this usually with pictures and things that would be hard to do in a radio show, but to show them how mindless that all of us tend to be. And when you see that, you say, oh my goodness, and look at the things that I misunderstood because I didn't bother thinking about it. You know, what happens often with people who get dread diagnoses, you know, you find out that you have cancer. And, well, you know, that's obviously not a pleasant circumstance. It turns out that many of the people who are diagnosed with things like cancer all of a sudden come alive. They realize that we're not here forever, And so they wake up and they notice the things around them, the people around them. And we have things like we travel, you know, so I might go to London or Australia, and if I were the typical person, I would be expecting to see new things. And it would be invigorating, and that's why people spend so much money for these vacations, without realizing that everything at home is also brand new. But it's not going to be appreciated as brand new if we keep looking through the same old lenses.
Mm-hmm. And can everyone shift into mindful thinking most of the time, or is it a select criteria? You know, in sort of Eastern philosophies, the path is often sort of led through as meditation, and you have to do a certain amount and, you know, to really get into that present state. Do you see there as being a set criteria to enable it to happen, or to do it all the time?
Now, that's a good question. It's not the case, I don't think, for most people that you notice five new things about anything and then that changes your entire life. Because we've been taught by all the institutions that you mentioned before, by our schools, our government, our businesses, everything, to be mindless. So it takes some time. However, relies on mindfulness. When we're at our leisure and enjoying ourselves, we're being mindful. So it's not as if it's work. You know, so it's time well spent. Now, Eastern forms of mindfulness, it's just meditation sets you up for post-meditative mindfulness. It's a different way of getting to the same place. But mindfulness, as I've been studying it and writing about it, is something that you can add to everything you're doing every moment of the day. You know, you sit down to a meal, decide to actually taste it after the first bite. When you're looking at somebody, notice the way that they're different to you. When you're at work, ask yourself, how was today different from yesterday? And in this noticing, you feel enlivened. So it's sort of, because it feels so good, it becomes self-perpetuating.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But yes, your original thought about it is, no, it's not going to be the case that 5 minutes of this will necessarily... 5 minutes could change your life, but it'll change your life if there's something that you're dreading and you look at it differently and all of a sudden you're not dreading it. You know,
mm-hmm.
So it can have tremendous changes instantly. But to become a person who walks through the world with a smile, with their head up, enjoying themselves... If it's been a person who has lived on the dark side, it's going to take a little time. Time well spent and time enjoyed being spent in this way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned in your book the role of an outcomes-based education system, which supports
right.
a mindless way of thinking, and rather than a mindful way of thinking. So what changes do you think need to be made to the systems in terms of education?
To
allow
it's
for the
interesting.
Positive
change? Right, that we have now a mistaken notion that we have good people and bad people and smart people and have convinced people that this is across all domains. And so there are a large number of people who walk around feeling left out and as if they're losers. I think that we need big changes, but they're actually easy to put in place. So what our educational systems do now is teach us facts that we're supposed to memorize as absolute statements. When you think you know it, again, it stops being interesting to you. You don't pay any new attention to it. So, for instance, for me, I learned, because I was a straight-A student, the Battle of Hastings was 1066. You say Battle of Hastings, I say 1066. You say 1066, I say Battle of Hastings. I know nothing else about the Battle of Hastings. It's not particularly useful information. You know. Mm-hmm. But if instead, when we were teaching something, we were teaching it in a more conditional way, that from one view, it looks like this, according to these people. That immediately makes you think, well, what about other people? How might they look at it? And how else can the whole situation be reconfigured? And school becomes more interesting. You know, we have people memorizing because the material is often just uninteresting. And that doesn't have to be. That if you play with the information, then it becomes interesting to you. And when it's meaningful and interesting, you don't have to memorize. You'll just know it.
And but how do you overcome that? The you know, you speak about sort of competence and then that automatic thinking. How do you overcome, you know, shifting into that mind of state when something is automatic, an automatic reaction like that, you know, in terms of becoming, you know, how do we overcome, we're trying to become competent at what we do, say, in our areas of work or any skill that we're liking. And how do you then maintain that mindfulness when it is almost becomes automatic, an automatic reaction?
Well, it is automatic. I mean, as I said before, that most people are sealed in unlived lives, and you have to make a decision to break that seal. You know, that it, I think that if people lived every day as if it was their first or their last, in either case, they would wake up to much that they now ignore. If you
can
are
I
an
ask
automatic
you about
pilot,
your...
well, but this is maybe important, that it may be that when people go through their lives, that much of the time there aren't cues that can help them be more mindful. But whenever something goes wrong, and the sad thing is things are going wrong all the time for people, so they are thrown into a state of thought, so to speak, that those thoughts can proceed mindfully or mindlessly. You can ask yourself a few very simple questions. How do I know this is going to happen? What are all the reasons that it might not happen? What are five ways that if it happens, it might actually be a good thing? And you do this every time you're upset, you become less upset. It becomes sort of automatic mindfulness. And again, then life just becomes easier. Every time you hear yourself...
Yeah, I like that. So
every time you hear
kind of
yourself being negative, every time you ask yourself, you see yourself being negative about somebody, ask what the behavior must have meant from their perspective. You know, that leads you to seeing somebody as impulsive, as spontaneous, and so on. And we come to appreciate people. And when we appreciate them, then they appreciate us. And, you know, again, things start to snowball, but now it's in a positive cycle.
Yeah. And how have you implemented this different way of sort of teaching and education in at Harvard? Have you brought
Well, it's very funny because in the Power of Mindful Learning book, I talk about the mindlessness of evaluation. And some student in a large lecture class at some point in the semester raises their hand and, you know, throws my words back at me and asks me, am I going to give them finals? Am I going to grade them? And I tell them that, you know, in this instance, I guess I'm a hypocrite. It's, you know, you can't fight all battles at once. But I think the question is a good one. I think that if we look for people's strengths rather than their weaknesses, if we recognize how everybody's behavior at any moment makes sense if we just take a different view of the context, then we don't end up with a culture of winners and losers. And if we didn't have winners and losers, then we wouldn't have all those losers bullying other people. We wouldn't have all those losers raping and stealing and doing all of these things in their mindless search to feel good about themselves. So I see this more than just as our education, but society as a whole would prosper from this, you know, we can call it an evolution in consciousness, where everybody just becomes more mindful and they become kinder to others and to themselves. And it's hard to understand all of this so quickly. But I think that the takeaway message for people, or one of them, would be just to try it, and just to notice new things. And every time they see them, you see yourself casting aspersions about somebody, to recognize that at those moments, you yourself are being mindless, which we don't want to be. So how else might we understand this? Instead of seeking single explanations for things, come up with multiple explanations And when we do, then we become less certain of any one of them. And the problem is people go to therapy, and the therapist will, you know, you'll think X, and the therapist will suggest some alternative, some Y. And then what happens is people mindlessly, on occasion at least, hold on to that Y as if it may be the case. So a mindful therapy would come up with X, Y, and Z. Here are all the things that might happen from not, from this, not just the one thing you've considered, but all of these others. And you think about how they can be true and what the consequences of any of them may be mindfully, which means good things, bad things, neutral things, and so on. And then you recognize that we just don't know. We just don't know. And then you don't feel so bad about not knowing, because that's the state of the world. The certainty is mindless. So it's not, you know, right now you have people who know they don't know, but they think you know. And then they genuflect to you, and you don't tell them you also don't know. But when we instead shift it from a personal attribution of not knowing, which is I don't know, but it's knowable and you know it, to an attribute, universal attribution of uncertainty. I don't know it, you don't know it, nobody knows it for sure. They can't, because it is always changing and it looks different from different perspectives. So now we're all sort of in the same boat and can start off with a little more respect for each other. Not knowing promotes mindfulness.
Fantastic. And in terms of, you know, a different perspective, I see that you're also an artist and a painter. Is that something you've always done, or is that part of your approach to increasing creativity and mindfulness?
Yeah, no, it was very funny how that happened. I mean, I would have, if you had asked me a year or even a week before I started painting, is this something I would end up doing, I would have wagered an awful lot of money that it would never happen. And I have a house on the Cape, and I spend summers there. And this was a summer where it was raining constantly. And so I'm in the house, and finally it stopped raining. And I went to the hardware store, and I ran into an artist friend. And it wasn't a close friend, and I ran out of things to say to her. And when she said, you know, how are you keeping yourself busy? And I said, you know, well, I'm thinking of taking up painting. And I don't know why I said that. But once I said it, then I thought, man, not a bad idea. Let me try. She had taken me to her studio and gave me a couple of canvases. And I said, no, one's enough, since I wasn't really serious about doing this. And she said, just do it. And then, this had never happened before, but in that same week, I think it was even the next day, I had to deliver something to this other person who is a phenomenal artist, who I also ran out of things to say and said that I was thinking of taking up painting. She said, get yourself an enormous canvas. Now, the first one gave me these tiny canvases. She's telling me, get an enormous canvas and just do it. And what was in common with both of them was the just do it. And at the time, I was writing a book about the mindlessness of evaluation. And I thought, you know, why? What's stopping me from just doing it? And it was strange to me, because being successful as a psychologist, never having any thoughts that I could do any art, it wouldn't seem that I had anything riding on this. But still, it was very hard, for fear that I wouldn't be able to do it. And so in the On Becoming an Artist book, which is really about interpersonal mindfulness, I, you know, go through this adventure, and I spend time, and from that time forward, where I would paint and I would notice something, and I would step back and I would wonder, is this something about mistakes, evaluation, talent, things like this? Is this true just for me, or is it true for everybody? And then I'd become a psychologist again, and I'd go and I'd do some research, and then I would be painting. It's very exciting. Both activities,
Do you see as being, you know, one of the avenues, or it was more your experiment with an area that you hadn't been in terms of, you know, the perhaps belief systems that we may have as children, and how that comes into something that we're doing, and how that plays out in our performance?
Yeah, no, I think art can serve that purpose, but the problem is, you know, art is better than many other things, because it's supposed to be subjective. But that's not really true. I mean, when I show my paintings to people, they rarely say, I like it or I don't like it. They say, it's good or it's not, you know, as if there's this fixed criteria. But at least there's a little more wiggle room as to what the criteria for excellence are, might be. And you can approach any and take up a new sport. You can do anything that's new. If you do it and you start, you know, I go through in the Mindful On Becoming an Artist book the roadblocks to us actually doing these new things. And if you can go through the steps that I outline there and you actually get yourself to start doing these things, you immediately experience the joy of being mindful. And the engagement that you experience is good for your health, not just feel, you know, not just your psychological well-being. One can also continue doing the, you know, look for what's new in the old things that they're doing. It may be a little harder. But, yeah, I suggest that one starts to paint, take a new sport up, take photography, a musical instrument, and just play with it. And yeah. every time you find it difficult, you start questioning yourself. Well, who says so? Why does it have to be this way or that way? What am I worried about?
So if you're listening, this is the Health and Happiness Show. I'm Edwina Griffin, and I'm speaking to Dr. Ellen Langer. So, Dr. Langer, you're doing a study on mindfulness and tennis. Is that right? Are you a bit of a tennis star yourself?
Yeah, I play a fair amount of tennis. I am very average, whatever that means. I'm an intermediate player. And, you know, whatever I'm doing, I notice the mindless things that people are taught about it. For example, I was playing tennis. I tend to play doubles. And I was playing next to these people who were having an argument with each other because one, they had gone to a tennis camp or something. And one was saying, no, we're both supposed to move up together to the net. And the other one said, no, one should be up. And I just went over there. I couldn't bear it and intruded in their game. And I told them, doesn't it depend on against whom you're playing? And if you were playing with my friend Rhoda and me against us, I have a very good drop shot. She has a wonderful lob. If they're both up, she's going to lob. If they're both back, I'm going to use the drop shot. You know, that it depends on the circumstances. And that's the essence of mindfulness, that it depends. And when people learn something, they tend to lock themselves into a way of doing it independent of the circumstances. So then they set themselves up for failure some of the time. And, you know, oftentimes, not so much with sports, well, even with sports, you know, that it just becomes less fun. You know, there was a woman I played with who had this wonderful shot down the alley. This other person who played far better than I said to her, Sarah, don't you know that's a low probability shot? Well, you know, later I took Sarah aside. I think there's a theme here. and I said, Sarah, it may be a low probability shot if you go across all people, but it's your best shot. You know, so I think it would be a mistake to give it up. So the bottom line is to change that, you know, our understanding of life is or I am or you do it this way, you know, all of these absolute statements to it depends on the circumstances. You want to be there to know how to be.
Yeah, because I know, you know, from my experience in competition sports, and we're always taught to focus on, you know, the final goal, the final result, you know, through training and seeing the future outcome. How does mindful learning fit into that model in terms of sports?
Well, I think that model
has
got problems. I think that there are lots of areas where people are taught to be goal-driven, and I think that that's a mistake. We want goals and routines to guide what we're doing, not to totally determine what we're doing, because there are times that we should change our goals. You know, that if you were even in this tennis game. If you are playing with somebody and your only goal is to win, but you see that this person who you care about on the other side of the net is being devastated by losing, so why play so hard? You know, the person's well-being might be more important than another victory. I'm not talking about professional sports, but just that if you had a goal to do something, you're making that goal when, let's say, you're 25, 30 years old. It may be the case that when you're 45 years old, you have a different set of values. And if you're mindlessly pursuing the goal, it doesn't even occur to you to reconsider whether you still want that. You know, lots of young people think they want a lot of money. And in some sense, almost sell their souls for all that money. But the money to do what? Well, if you want the money to be happy, there are other ways of being happy. Do you understand what I'm saying? So, you know, that we can have goals. We can have goals, but we want to stay present with those goals and deciding, do we still feel that we want that goal to be true for us now because we had decided on that goal in the distant past?
Yeah.
We want to update our goals.
It reminds me of, you know, sometimes when you see the kids' sporting matches and the parents running down the side screaming at their kids. Just about how they're playing. And it's, you know, that's kind of where what you're talking about resonates with me. They all needed a little bit of that mindfulness.
And wouldn't it be nice for them to enjoy it? And, you know, at all ages, an interesting thing is that if you're doing whatever you're doing mindfully, you're more likely to be successful. In fact, we've even found that the things people produce are better, evaluated by others as better when they're mindfully produced. We had orchestras where we had them playing mindfully versus the way most musicians in these orchestras play. You know, so when they were mindful, they were told, make it new in very subtle ways that only you would know. And they had to be subtle because they were playing classical music. And we, you know, versus the other groups that were told, remember a time you played this piece and just replicate your performance, you know, that you enjoyed or thought was good. And then we tape it and we play it for people, and almost everybody prefers the mindfully played piece. And then we ask the musicians which they enjoyed playing most, and they overwhelmingly prefer playing mindfully. So mindfulness, in a sense, leaves its footprint in the things that we do, the products we create. So we don't lose anything by this. It's not when people often say to children, you know, it doesn't matter if you win or lose, it's how you play the game, and then they're screaming at them the whole time that they're not running fast enough or whatever in the sport you were suggesting, that it doesn't have to be an either-or, that if you're totally engaged, enjoying what you're doing, noticing, you will do it better and then be more likely to meet that goal.
Fantastic. Now, also, you've developed the Langer Mindfulness Scale. So it's, I think, a 21 questionnaire for training.
We've just revamped it and we have a shorter version. But this is an ongoing project.
Okay, and is that for organizations to use? And is that no?
No,
it's more
for research purposes. Eventually, we may put it out there for industry, but I'm a little afraid of that because I shudder at the thought that somebody would give this scale and then make a hiring decision or a promotion decision based on it, because no scale is going to be perfect, like everything else that I mentioned.
Yeah, and it's kind of going against the mindful approach, I guess.
In fact, to have a scale is almost oxymoronic, right? Because I could give you all the answers, and then you take it, and then does that mean you're mindful?
Yeah. No. Yeah, but we like that box. Okay, fair enough. So what do you do in your own day-to-day to keep yourself mindful?
I have my moments of mindlessness. I just experienced something the other day, which wasn't my mindlessness, but it's kind of funny, that the people at Harvard, the computer people, switched over my email, And so people all morning were getting messages. They would send me an email, and they would get a return message saying that there was an error, and the email, my emails are not going through, some version of that. And the funny thing was, so you get a, you send me an email, you get a message saying, I can't get your email. And what do you do? Mm-hmm. Well, what the people I know have been doing is they would write me an email telling me that I'm not getting their emails. And then there were a couple of people who thought to call me on the telephone or to text me or something different. But the for most of the others, it just didn't occur to them that I'm not going to get that email.
If you're not getting it.
So okay. I think that, you know, that I, in general, have it's important to me to be non-evaluative and to notice. And I think that, you know, you do this enough and you're, you know, you remain confident but uncertain, and you don't have to do anything special. It's just sort of a way of being. It becomes a way of being.
Now, the film, I want to go back to the film, that Counterclockwise, it's based on that Counterclockwise study, and it stars Jennifer Aniston playing you, is that correct?
Yeah, Jennifer Aniston playing me. It's interesting. I spoke to one of the producers last week, because I was going to an event where I knew I was going to run into a lot of people, and they were going to ask me, how is the movie coming along? And I said to them, what should I tell people? And they said, things that are good are worth waiting for. So, you know, it's moving at glacial speed. But, you know, that's actually fine for me, because once it's out, then it is whatever it is. And now I get the chance to play with it in my mind. And I generally live in the world of possibility. And it's an exciting place to be. So it's fine with me that it hasn't come out yet. But the BBC's version of this, where they had British celebrities live in a house that was retrofitted to 20 years earlier, 30 years earlier, they did an excellent job. And I think people, right now, people in Australia, England, India, Hong Kong, I think there are a few other places can see the series. We can't see it in the United States yet, which is interesting. And Germany is redoing it with German actors, and Holland is redoing it with Dutch actors. And so that's the part that's exciting to me, is I don't care what the vehicle is, but just to get the word out there that more is possible.
Absolutely. You speak about also psychology of possibility, both in our thoughts and language. Have you had what results have you had around that areas of health and happiness? And
enormous. I give an example of a couple of these studies. So in one study, we give people an eye test, you know, the eye chart that everybody knows, which people don't realize. They know that the letters get progressively smaller from top to bottom, but they don't realize that implicitly this tells you that soon you're not going to be able to see. So we do a very simple thing. We reverse the eye chart. Now the letters get progressively larger, implicitly telling you soon you will be able to see. And what happens is people can see what they couldn't see before. We did a study with chambermaids. These are women who exercise all day long, who don't see themselves as getting exercise. If exercise is so good for you, then they should be healthier than similar others who don't exercise. But it turns out they're not. So we take half of these women. We teach them that their work is exercise. Everything else about their lives stays the same, right? They're eating the same foods. They're working in the same fashion, exerting the same energy, and so on. The only thing that has changed is their mindset, going from work isn't exercise, or not considering it as exercise, to realizing work is exercise. We come back 6 weeks later, they've lost weight, there's a significant change in waist-to-hip ratio, body mass index, and their blood pressure has come down.
Wow.
So as I keep saying, that our minds are, we're far more, have far more control over every aspect of our lives than most people imagine. And those are just a few examples. We start off believing that eyesight has to get worse over time, aging, memory has to get worse, all of these things. And I say, well, why? Why do we accept that is true? So we have study after study where we do some of these simple things, and we find that lots of these things that are supposed to get worse can get better. But they're not going to get better if we don't think there's a chance they could get better. If we don't see it as possible, then we don't take the steps to make the changes. And the fun thing, I mean, is that even if we're wrong, even if you set out to do something and it turns out you're not able to achieve the goal you were setting out to achieve, the very act of noticing new things and embarking on the activity has health effects and leads us to be happier by making us more engaged. So you can't lose. Mm-hmm. It feels good. It's easy to do. And the ramifications are enormous.
Mm-hmm.
I keep giving these summary statements.
No, it's great,
I
though.
Realize that.
It's, you know, that's
it
what
okay?
shifts our thinking. You know, as I chat to you, I feel like I'm shifting. You know,
that's good.
That's
okay.
Right. You know, that's what it's about. Now you've inspired, you know, millions of people, but also other scientists in their researches. Is there anyone who inspires you, or what keeps you, you know, going and coming up with these new ideas? Is this just the way
yeah,
your mind works?
You know,
have you?
Yeah. I've never had any trouble with ideas. I mean, my problem is that there are too many, and so my students get crazy because I want to do all these experiments. Everybody's doing too much, and then I come up with another set of ideas. It just happened. I think somebody had once described me in a particular way, and I said, you know, well, you know, maybe I'm not that, you know, all that smart. He said, okay, let's make it that you're like a Martian. You could be a perfectly average Martian, but people here don't know Martians. And so I think that for whatever reason, possibly just because I had very loving, supportive parents, I don't know what the reason for it is. All I know is that I notice things that other people don't seem to notice. And that gives rise to these experiments, you know, once I get some strange idea. So, for example, I was watching somebody smoking. And they had this, I think, Mad Men. Everybody is smoking every minute of the show. And there was a different feeling that I experienced when a person was putting out the cigarette from when they first lit the cigarette. So being sensitive to these subtle changes in me, I thought, well, maybe if one sort of imagines themselves going through the whole experience of smoking, for example, to its end, then they won't want the cigarette. You know, so some of these ideas are very strange, but then I go to my lab and I talk to my students, and some of them are as strange as I am, and we end up doing research. We're studying that, but we don't have any findings yet. So most of my ideas come from my own experience rather than from, you know, I've had wonderful teachers, but I think that even they would find me odd.
Who do you think would be, you know, one of your greatest teachers, if you were to name? Would there be anyone that stands out?
Oh, gee. I'm going to pass on that. We finally found a question. I won't answer.
Yeah, no, that's true. It sounds
because
like
I don't, because
you're
it really
everyone.
It would be misleading since you know, I take something from, you know, from virtually each interaction. And so to answer that question would suggest that there are some, I mean, clearly, well, I was a graduate student at Yale, the faculty there, you know, in teaching me the discipline were very important. I think that social psychology, which tends to look for interactions, you know, if you do this, you get X, Y, or Z, but only sometimes. If you do this other thing, it reverses. And that's sort of built into the discipline, and that is an important part of this mindful thinking. So if I had to speak to an influence, it would be about the method rather than any particular person. You know,
right.
I think that the teachers who were most important in my life are the ones that were supportive. the ones who, and many of them were. And rather than, you know, if I gave an answer that was different from the answer they were expecting, which is exactly what I think that one should do, what they did was not ignore me or tell me I'm wrong, but to ask me how I came to that understanding. And if we do that, then what happens is the child, for example, who says one and one is one, teaches us something, rather than goes home feeling belittled.
And what other research, could you tell us anything about some of the research you're doing currently at Harvard? You mentioned.
We're doing a lot of these mind-body studies. You know, that's of the sort of the counterclockwise or the vision of a chambermaid, you know, where we put the mind in a new place and take our measurements from the body. We're doing some studies on decision-making and, you know, regret, for example, that when you are mindfully doing what you're doing, you don't experience regrets because you know why you're doing what you're doing. So, for example, if I decided after I got off the phone that, gee, I just want to watch silly television, not even a good television program, because I don't want to, I don't know, for whatever reason, all right, but I'm aware of this, then I find out that if I had only been in my office, there was this person coming by who was giving out large sums of money. I say, well, okay. But if I did, you know, get off the phone and then I go watch some television, and I'm not sure why I'm doing it, I don't even ask the question, I just do it, then I'm going to feel regret. If you have a party I don't go to, and the reason I don't go to it is because I'm very aware that right now I need time to myself. And then I find out I missed the party of the decade. Well, I'm glad you had a wonderful party, but I'm not going to be turned inside out about it. But if I just don't go without attending to my feelings about why I'm making this decision, then, you know, at that future time when I find out I missed this one-time-only event, I don't have access to why I missed it, and then I just feel foolish. And we have a lot of data, not a lot, I should. We have a couple of studies where we have people being mindful, and then an experience happens where they discover that they missed out on something. And we find across them that when they're mindful, they don't experience regret. I don't know if, you know, it's, for example, in one of these studies, we had people, they're in a room, the experimenter comes in, and they're told, okay, the experiment's downstairs. When you see that light, and it points to a light overhead, when that light starts blinking, come downstairs for the study. Everybody is told that. One group is told, while you're here, you might as well spend some time thinking about your feelings. Another group is not told anything. Another group is given Seinfeld episodes to watch. Okay, about half hour later, the experimenter comes back and says, why didn't you come downstairs? Joe won $150, Sarah won $280, and they go on like this. And the question is, who was going to be upset at having missed that? Well, it turns out the people who watched Seinfeld, they had a wonderful time. They didn't care that much. The people who spend time thinking about their thoughts, being in the present with themselves, didn't have any regrets. The people who just sat there felt regret and anger that they had missed the opportunity. Lots of things, subtle and not so subtle, change when we change our way of living and become, you know, more mindful.
So are there any quick tips or suggestions you've got for the listeners on what they can start doing in their day now?
Whatever they're doing, ask themselves what's new about it. There's always something new. If you reach for an apple, it's not the same apple. It's a slightly different size. You're slightly hungrier or less hungrier. You're reaching with your right hand or your left hand. No matter what you're doing, notice the ways it's different. More important with the people that you're with, or, you know, anybody that you've belittled. Know that that belittling is mindless. And ask yourself, how that might have made sense, their behavior might have made sense from their perspective. That's like the rigid and consistent that I mentioned before. And continue this. Tomorrow, open the door. It's a new day. Or if people are stressed, and so many people are depressed and stressed, you know, ask yourself about the thing that's stressing you. How do you know it's going to happen? What are five reasons that it might not happen? Take each of, take the thing that you're afraid of that you think might happen that may be the end of the world, and ask yourself, give yourself five, three, I'm making up these numbers, ways that this might actually be a blessing. You know, go back to the example I gave before about you're afraid that your partner, that your spouse, boyfriend, girlfriend, is going to leave. Well, if you're worried about that, it's not a good relationship in the first place. And what would be all the advantages of actually being in a fulfilling relationship? And so on. So we just have to accept the bottom line is accept that uncertainty is the rule. And every time we're certain something's going to happen, somebody is a certain way, that we need certain things, whatever the certainty is, we need to question it. We need to say, how can it be otherwise? How do we know that this is the case? When is it not true? And then people will emerge less evaluative, gentler, kinder, and more effective with respect to everything that they're doing, whether it's painting, coming up with experiments, writing, playing golf, no matter what it is. Right now, everything that we do, everything, talking on the phone, cooking a meal, having a conversation, everything is done either mindfully or mindlessly. The ramifications of switching all or part of those to being more mindful is enormous. So all I can do is hope that people have heard at least part of this, that they try it, and that they see. As I said before, humor is based on mindfulness. Something is funny only when you recognize that this thing that you thought of one way can be understood another way. So that should lead people to realize that being mindful is more fun. I know a final line. I think that one of the things that I think is very important for people is to take what they do seriously, but not take themselves so seriously. And if we don't take ourselves so seriously and we become a little more lighthearted, I think that life will open up and ask ourselves, is this thing that's bothering us so, is it a tragedy or is it just an inconvenience? And most of these things are just inconveniences. They provide challenges for us.
Yeah. That's a great note to finish on. Is there anything else you wanted to
say? Oh, there's so much else. There's 40 years.
I know, there's so much, but I like that summary to finish off. I think that's a really strong, powerful message for us all to take away for a day or evening, depending on where everyone is in the world. Dr. Langer, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much for being on the show. If people
want
to buy your books, they can buy them at Amazon and via your website, ellenlanger.com.
Right. That was a clever name, right?
Yes.
For a website.
Very clever. And the movie's soon to come out, soon to be released, so we'll all be keeping an eye out for that. And it's called Counterclockwise after the book, is that correct?
I don't, you know, that's the working title.
The film name.
I don't know what it'll end up.
Okay. Well, no doubt it'll be written up everywhere, and we can all look forward to seeing that as well. Thank you again. It's been great having you on the show. And so ellenlanger.com, if you're wanting to look up any more of Ellen's work or get some of her amazing books and research. Now, next week on the show, on the Health and Happiness Show, I'll be speaking to Dr. Joe Dispenza, neuroscientist, chiropractor, and author, who featured in What the Bleep Do We Know. We'll be speaking about his approach to training mind and his new book, Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself, How to Lose Your Mind and Create a New One. So tune in next week at 8 o'clock a.m. Australian time, so same time around the world, 11 p.m. London and 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And thanks for joining us today, and I'll see you next week. Signing out.